Welcome to We Are Chafee's Looking Upstream, a conversational podcast of community, humanness, and well-being rooted in Chafee County, Colorado. I'm Adam Williams. Today, I'm talking with Ryan Short. Ryan co-founded Civic Brand with his wife, Banner, many years ago. We talk about it being 15 years ago in the conversation, but I realized after the fact it's actually reaching 16 years right now as this episode is released. Civic Brand is an innovative city branding and placemaking agency. In fact, I'd even say a pioneering agency that focuses on helping communities become the best version of themselves. And they do this with a thoughtful locals first approach, which I think all of us living here in the Arkansas Valley can appreciate. I like to think that that community focus on connection and civic pride is something that Civic Brand and Looking Upstream have in common. In fact, Ryan had me on his Civic Brand podcast called Eyes on the Street to talk about community storytelling last year because we do share those interests. But Ryan and Civic Brand do their work nationwide, which means he travels the country quite a bit. And when the opportunity arises, like on a recent work/play trip to Alaska, he gets to enjoy the intersection of purposeful work, travel, family, and their shared love of fishing and spending time in the wild. So I asked Ryan about that Alaska experience and that intersection of his life's priorities. We talk about the values of travel and what we teach our sons. We each have two. About life through travel. We talk about placemaking. Like, what is it? And how place shapes all of us. And we talk about cultivating fulfillment in life and making bold, unconventional decisions when the moment calls for it. Like when Ryan and Banner founded Civic Brand in 2008 under shaky economic circumstances and during a pivotal time in their household. Ryan shares why they went for it when most others would have let the decisive moment pass by. The Looking Upstream podcast is supported by Chafee County Public Health and the Chafee Housing Authority. As with every Looking Upstream episode, show notes with photos, links, and a transcript of the conversation are published at wearechafeepod.com. Okay, here is Ryan Short. So you recently were in Alaska, and I saw photos and videos that you were posting online from that. And I've got to say, I've never gotten out into Alaska. I've always gotten hung up at the airport on my way through.
Okay.
And obviously, I've seen photos and things from the places, but yours and the glacier, the waters, the everything looks so beautiful and amazing. I want to hear about that experience for you.
Yeah. I mean, it was incredible. I mean, I had... the pictures you're talking about was probably half from a work trip and then half from, you know, my wife and kids came up on the tail end of a work trip and we kind of turned it into a family thing. But I'd been to Alaska one time before and it was as part of a cruise with my wife's family. And, you know, it was nice, but I felt like I was like next to Alaska and like, I could, you know, and like you'd get to go on shore for a couple hours and then get ushered back to the boat. And
yeah,
you're surrounded by other cruisers at the time. And, you know, so it was cool, but it was like, I was like, just so yearning to like, I want to get into Alaska. Like, I want to see Alaska. And, so yeah, with work, we had the opportunity to go up there. We're doing a project with the Mattsu Valley, which is like it's a borough, but that's what they call their counties in Alaska.
Okay.
It's basically a county branding project. And so on those types of projects, our first trip is always just to like get immersed in the place and see all the things that there are to see and do all the things that there are to do. And so, I mean, our team got to go land a helicopter on a glacier and like drink literally from the like little pool. It's like this like most amazing, like looks like Gatorade, like this fake blue water.
It was so blue. Yeah. That was part of what stood out to me.
Yeah. I mean, it was wild. Like I'd seen pictures of that and kind of assumed that it was like a little photoshopped, you know, and,
to enhance it.
Yeah. But it's not, I mean, it literally looked like Windex. Like it was wild. And you just land on the glacier and we're like, is this safe? Like, should we even be walking on the, you know? But yeah, I mean, Alaska is a pretty special place. I mean, it's so massive. I think that's the biggest like takeaway for me is like, And that's even our project, what we're tasked with, is kind of the challenge of like, how do you make it digestible for someone planning a visit there or a trip there? Because people think like, yeah, we'll fly into Anchorage, we'll run up to Denali, and then we'll go down to Seward and see that. And it's like what you just described would be like saying, you know, yeah, let's go to California for vacation. Well, you don't say that. You say like a city or Southern California, at least. You're not like, yeah, we'll run up to San Francisco and then down to LA. And so I think the size and scale just contributes, I think, to the like epicness of Alaska.
For sure.
Yeah.
It's interesting the way you described almost voyeurism of Alaska from the cruise ship. It's like, I don't get to actually touch this thing and get out and experience the wild of it.
Yeah.
And it is epically wild, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think, is it physically somewhere around like a third or so the size of the lower 48? I mean, it's massive.
It's massive, yeah. And I don't know exactly, but like our whole world's view of how we view the world is like so skewed because we're used to looking at flat print maps.
Yeah.
And so even just the fact that like, oh yeah, it's round. Russia is like right there. It's actually like wrapped up, you know, and like when you think of like when you'd fly back, like you feel like you're going out of the way, but it's like, well, no, that's actually, if you look at a globe, that's like the most direct route. And so, yeah, there's a lot of just interesting things about like its orientation and how it's turned. Like you think it's turned, I don't know. It's just weird because I think our brains are so
linear,
you know, yeah,
in that way.
The map we had hanging on our classrooms in school back in the day.
The reason I've passed through the airport up there every time I have, maybe a few or a handful of times, was to go to Asia. And yeah, it might have been on a latitude similar to wherever I was in the lower 48, but we're going up through there.
Yeah.
For the reasons that you're saying and the curvature and the way that efficiently actually works. And it is amazing. The reason I wanted to start with Alaska, besides my own curiosity and wanting to hear something of your travel story, is because I feel like that represents a combination of some key things that seem like they're pretty important to you, maybe the priorities for you. You mentioned work. I want to get into that. I'm really curious about what it is you do with branding, placemaking. But your family also got to join you at some point on this trip. So there's travel, there's your work, there's family, and all of you fish. And that became part of this amazing trip as well. I wonder how you feel about the intersection of so much that matters to you with something like that.
I mean, obviously those are the biggest things, you know, work and family. And I think for me at least, and I think, I think both my wife and I have just tried to be super intentional about everything that we can control to a degree and making sure that those things aren't like separate things, right? So my wife and I, we started our company together. We work together. So we're together. I know some couples are like, oh, we could never do that. That doesn't work for
us. You
know? But like we work together. So we're together all day. And then we're parents together with our kids. And then we go out together. And, you know, so I view those, I mean, immediately family and work is already intertwined just because we work together. But I think also trying to do work that is fun. And, you know, if you're going to be at work, let's try to make it at least a little bit of fun. And that, yeah, when we do go to, we get to work with places, which is, you know, a big part of the whole thing of what we do. And being able to experience different places, like I love being able to bring my kids along. I mean, I think that's like the biggest thing in a kid's life is just like everything that they see, it just kind of expands their horizon of what's possible. You know, I mean, there's so many kids out there that like, I mean, my kids, I'll be the first to tell you, like they're so spoiled. Like they've been a ton of great places, and that's, you know, and there's a ton of kids that like they just haven't ever left the town that they grew up in. And I think that's so valuable of like, you know, to just making you a more empathetic person, making you a better person. It's like the more you can see, the more places you can see, the more types of people you can see, I think is not just fun. It's like super, super necessary for us to like just be better people.
I agree. And that is also a philosophy in our household. And thankfully, we're able to travel with our two sons. You also have two sons. They're teenagers. Mine are slightly younger, with only one having made it to teen years so far. And all the travel that we've gotten to do with a very similar mindset, it's to not have out there and other be so foreign.
Right.
But to bring it in closer and get to have experiences. And then often if we're watching TV shows or we're watching movies, to be able to point out, oh, this is set in Paris, or this is set in whatever country or whatever city that we've been to, even in the U.S. as well, you can't take away those memories. You've been there. You have that connection. Now you feel a little bit more invested in the place, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, and I think you realize, like, I know I was just talking about how big Alaska is, but I think you also start to realize, like, kind of how small the world is, you know, too. It's like, yeah, we're just over here. We're just in a different spot where, you know, these people are pretty normal people, you know, even when you go to, like, I mean, I haven't done as much traveling overseas as a lot of people. And, you know, so a lot of my travel has been like in the States and, you know, Alaska and a little bit in like the UK. But yeah, I mean, I think you just start to get that, like, the world shrinks a little bit the more you travel. And it seems like, it doesn't seem crazy that, like, I was in Alaska and then the next week I was in New Hampshire for a work project. It's like, those seem, you know, some people are like, oh my God, that seems crazy. And it's like, yeah, well, it's one plane ride no matter what, you know?
It sets such a tone, and it's a modeling of it for your boys to be like, this is normal in our lives to go experience what other people are doing and living and find the common ground in that, right? Like, it's not all just differences.
Right.
We get a chance to learn those, but I think more importantly, just like with conversations like this, if you actually spend time with people, you get a chance to figure out what you have in common when you might not think you did.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, so the work we do is with cities, it's with places and destinations, right? And I think one thing that we even see, you know, when we go talk to cities, there's a couple themes that always come up, and that's one, they definitely think that their problems and challenges are so unique to them, right? They're like, well, we've got this parking problem downtown. And you're like, every city does. If you don't have a parking problem, you have other problems, right? Or they think they have a housing problem. It's like, you do. And a lot of communities like ours here, it's worse than in a lot of places. But every place is struggling with those things. And I think cities and people also do themselves a disservice when they're like, you know, you start to like cite an example or maybe something I could learn from another place. And it's like, well, we're not that, right? I think here in mountain towns, we'd like to, you know, if you start talking to somebody about a solution to a community problem, you're saying, well, in Breckenridge, they like, whoa, we're not Breckenridge. Like, we don't want to be Breckenridge. And it's like, we know, point taken, but like, doesn't mean there's not something you could learn about a way they approach something, right? And so I think, yeah, just people, cities, places, like we should be able to learn from people from a lot of different places and not just say like, well, they're different. They're not us. You know, I get that in the civic world and city planning world, like Americans, we don't love the like European examples. Like, you know, you're talking to somebody about bike infrastructure and you show them pictures of Amsterdam. It's like, well, we're not Amsterdam, you know, but they
don't want to be.
Right. Yeah. Right. Or they don't want to be. But they also probably don't realize that Amsterdam in the 70s was like full of cars and traffic and pollution. And like they made conscious value-based choices. And so, yeah, I mean, I think seeing those things and being open to like, what can I learn from somebody that's different, a place that's different. And I think it's fine even when you don't like the place or you don't like the person.
We tend to be this way as individuals too, where we say, no, my issues, only I am feeling this. Only I am going through this. You don't understand, you know? And then again, when we make connection and we kind of learn, we're actually part of a bigger web of commonality.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I was listening to a podcast this morning. It was Adam Grant's podcast, and he was talking with David Dunning. If people are familiar with the Dunning-Kruger effect, and it's the tendency to be overly confident about our ignorance, to be unaware, to be ignorant of how ignorant we are on things. And this exact example was brought up. When people try to tell you what you maybe need to work on, no, that's not me. But they can identify the exact same thing in somebody else.
Right. Yeah.
and then separate themselves somehow. I want to go more directly into Civic Brand. You mentioned that you started this company with your wife, Banner, 15 years ago, and it's about branding, it's about placemaking. I'm curious about, in particular, the word placemaking. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Yeah. I mean, I guess first just starting with like place, right? Like, I think it's, and this is something that I didn't even know when we started, you know, our company. I kind of learned it as we went along just naturally, like, is just how important your physical surroundings, like the place that you're in, shapes who you are as a person, how happy you are, how healthy you are, your relationships, like so much of that is dictated by the place that you're in, you know? And I think when we look at, you know, I think it's very easy for a lot of our population, you know, you can live in a nice house and it's air conditioned, and you can walk to your garage and get in your car, which is air conditioned, and sit in traffic for an hour, and then get into your office, which is air conditioned, and then go into your cubicle and work, and then drive home. And so like in that setting, it's no surprise that there's a lot of unhappy people, right? Like you're isolated, you're by yourself. You're never actually outside. You're in a house and then to a car, into another building, and back into the car, into another building. And so I think just that idea that like place shapes you, and whether that's your building that we're in, your car, your town, your country, like all of those things shape how happy, healthy you are. And I think so placemaking and some of the work that we do is like, how can we make these places better? How can we make them to where it helps people be happier, healthier, you know, have more civic pride, have more connection with their neighbors. And I think, you know, that's where some of the, you know, we're not architects, we're not urban planners. Our work definitely crosses over into that. And we work with a lot of those folks, but we're a little bit more on like the brand and, you know, identity side of that world and kind of activating public spaces and doing those things, but all with the like same intent of, you know, just like an architect is trying to think about how people walk through a building and experience, they are thinking about like mental health and air quality and a lot of different nuanced things to design a building. We're wanting to think about the same thing of like a place, and whether that's a district, a town, a borough. So yeah, that's kind of the, I guess not short answer, the kind of the medium long answer.
I've long been fascinated by this. If somebody grows up outdoors, they grew up out in the mountains in a rural town, an area like where we live, you're going to have a very different filter on the world than if you grow up in a congested suburb in a massive sprawling city area somewhere, or in the city where maybe you have mass transit, maybe you live in a neighborhood that's rough in that city. Mm-hmm. Now you have a food desert. Now you have danger. You have like all of these things shape so much about who we are, what we prioritize, how we experience the world, how we maybe view others who we, you know, are coming from these other places that maybe we don't understand.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. Is there something that you have learned about the people and the ways that they've been shaped or the lenses that they use, you know, in this kind of conversation with you?
Yeah. I mean, I think literally just yesterday, my wife and I were driving back into town and we were just talking about, I can't remember why it came up. We were talking about like kind of like in the environment, right? Like kind of environmental politics and like why people, like why some people are very like pro environment and that matters to them. That's a big part of their life, and why, you know, other parties aren't. And we came down to this like realization that it's so much about just like your proximity to it. It's not that like people in some part of the country are politically, you know, don't care about the environment. It's that in my example I just gave, and that's actually why I gave that car example, is like in that example, that person that's in goes from air conditioned space to air conditioned space, they're so insulated from the outdoors that like they're probably less likely to be an environmentalist. And it's not because of any character flaw of them, or they just don't care, or they're like greedy or selfish. It's just that they don't experience it. They don't feel it. They don't feel when it's like hotter than normal. They don't smell smoke when there's a forest fire. They don't notice that the river is higher or lower. They don't notice all of those things. And those that live in a place where you do see those things, and I mean, where we are, I feel like we're sort of on the front lines. And when we stood on that glacier in Alaska, I felt like we're on the absolute front line of like climate change, because you're literally watching the glaciers melt, right? And so it's just about like place can also insulate you from everything. And that shapes your politics. That shapes everything. And so I would say that person that sits in that car and makes that commute, I would say they don't care less about the environment. They just haven't had an opportunity to experience it, you know?
Yeah. When we talk about environmental matters, one of the things that comes up often is, but if we get more people out to hike or to camp or to fish or experience something that is new and maybe they don't have access to if they're living deep into an urban environment, well, then what we're doing is creating an interest in preserving, in caring, in protecting. But there's also then the risk that balances that, which is if we get too many people out there,
yeah,
then we also are putting it all at risk.
100%. Yeah. I mean, I think that's something that I personally even wrestled with of like, but I guess where I landed on that is we have to just acknowledge that like, okay, we're humans by being, we're kind of a problem, right? Mm-hmm. Like we're kind of sort of a cancer to the earth, right? But if we are going to be here and continue to be here, we need to just make the best of it, right? And so I think if you start with that attitude, then I think those like opportunities to like, yeah, let's bring more people into the outdoors. Let's bring more people into recreation so that they experience it, so that they fall in love with it, so that they then want to protect it. That's to me the only path forward, because the alternative is just, well, let's just get rid of people then, you know? And I don't think we're at that stage yet, hopefully. And so, I mean, to me, you mentioned that we like, my family, we like to fish, right? I think fishing is the same way, you know, with most fly fishing, it's like catch and release. And it's, you know, most people that are into fly fishing are pretty, you know, environmentally conscious, right? Very delicate with like how you handle the trout and keep them wet and like release them. But I think to fall in love with that, you have to like take kids fishing and you got to let them kind of probably squeeze a stocker trout a little too hard and be a little rough with them and drop them and not, but it's so that they can learn and so that they can like fall in love with fishing so that they can then protect it. And then they can, you know, cause if they don't ever hold that fish and they don't ever like see beauty in it, then why were they going to care about protecting a river? Why are they going to care about anything related to that?
Yeah. Yeah. I want to talk about more deeply, I guess, into what it is you do as Civic Brand. Maybe I'm mistaken. In my mind, what you're talking about for boosting, let's say, image, well, actually, I'll let you define how all this works in your work. But in my mind, it was probably tourism bureaus. It was maybe, depending on the size of city, the Chamber of Commerce, who was charged with that responsibility of wanting to promote the town. What is it that you are actually doing? And is it a pioneering sort of agency that you run? Is this common? And I just did not know that there were people like you out here doing this for all this time.
Yeah. I mean, so I think the simplest way to say what we do, it's like we are a design and engagement consultant for cities and places, right? And there's definitely more of us than there were even 10 years ago, but there's not many. You know, there's a lot of branding firms that, you know, they're ad agencies and they do hotel campaigns and restaurants and they'll dip their toe into branding a destination. But that's not what we are. You know, we are like, we just work with places. And we really kind of founded the company on, there's a quote by a person named Jane Jacobs. She was kind of an activist in New York City and kind of like a urban planning world. She's cited a lot. And the quote is, cities can provide something for everybody only because and only when they're created by everybody. And so we kind of use that as like our sort of mission. And so because of that, we start everything with public engagement and starting with the people that are there, the locals. And, you know, I am like the biggest homer for locals and support local and local businesses to where even when we are hired to do a tourism campaign, you know, that is, the client might even think like, this is all about, how do we just get more visitors here? How do we just fill up hotels? Our process starts with, well, how does that benefit the locals? What is the local story? You know, that because when you visit a place, you're not just going to see their buildings and like their attractions, like you're going to somebody's home, you're going to somebody's place and you're going to experience it. And I think best case scenario, you go home, not just with like a souvenir, but you go home with like a value and you take something that you carry with you. And so just like how, I guess with my fishing example of, you know, I'm going to let a kid come squeeze a stocker fish a little too tightly, but he's going to fall in love with fishing and want to protect fish the rest of his life. Let's have a visitor come to our town. Yeah. They're going to kind of walk in the street and, you know, be a bumbling tourist a bit, but man, is there a value that we as locals here have that they can take home with them and make their place better? And we've now influenced their whole, you know, so we do engagement. It's a huge part of what we do to understand what is this place's values, and every place is different. So, you know, the Matsu Valley in Alaska, we're not just doing the cool helicopter rides in Glacier. We're talking to businesses. We're talking to the tribal leaders up there of like, what is this place? Why does it matter to you? Why do you choose to be here? What are the values? And then how can we weave that into something that's beneficial? How can tourism work for you and benefit you? How can we improve this place so that people see your values when they walk through the street and experience them? So it starts with engagement, but then kind of comes out the other end as design, placemaking, messaging,
marketing sometimes.
You travel the whole country doing this, so you get a chance to see a lot of different cities, and I think of varying sizes, probably, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Is there something in common? If we go back to those pain points and where people think it's only us yeah. that is struggling with this, you know, parking or whatever, is there something in common that you see or patterns of what it is, the way people want their city to be? What is it they want to demonstrate as values and welcome from tourists with values that they maybe want to have be part of it?
Yeah. I mean, I think the challenging or unfortunate part is we kind of want the best of both worlds with a lot of things, right? Like we want most places like want all the benefits of tourism, right? And visitors and
the money
and economics, but we don't want the people, like, right? So like, could we have both of those things? Right. And so, I mean, we even see that here, like when it's a shoulder season and it's really slow, it's like people get a little nervous and it's like, man, hope things pick up, you know, it's like pretty slow. And then as soon as it picks up, it's like, oh, tourists are here, you know? And so I think a lot of places, you know, this is a seasonal community. Tourism is seasonal here, but there's a lot of places that even if it's not a tourist town, like they're maybe on like they're not on seasonal highs and lows. They're on like economic highs and lows. Like maybe they were a factory town and they were booming. And then now that factory's gone away and now they're struggling. Right. And so it's like, they want that back. But then as soon as it's back, they're like complain about the traffic or something, you know? And so I think that's a very just common thread is like, we all kind of want to be the last one in, you know, to a place. We're attracted to a place that's vibrant, has things going on. But then as soon as we're there, we kind of want to close the door. It's a very, I guess, American thing. Why I guess we're trying to build a wall around our country is, you know, we love it. We want to be here. We like the opportunity. Most of us came from descendants of you know, Europe and other places. But now that we're here, we want to stop that. So I think that's just I wouldn't even say it's American. It's probably just a very human trait that like
it probably is. It's just America happens to be a country and a young enough one that the history of so many people, well, the melting pot idea, right, yeah. is people are coming from so many places. It's very easy to, again, use the word other to otherize everybody and say, no, your people, your kind, your ethnicity, your language, your whatever, we don't want that here.
Yeah.
Because I got in the door.
Yeah.
I'm the last one.
Yeah.
So I want to find out how you got into this work, how you ended up founding this agency, this company with your wife. Again, 15 years, you were doing some career work before this, I think, right?
Yeah. So I graduated college probably I'm 44, so 20 plus 22 years ago, probably. Worked in the music industry a little bit, like small record label, you know, kind of thought that that's what I wanted to do. Had a job that at the time was the best job that I had, you know, and then my wife and I were married. And so when we started the company, it was 2008. And she was pregnant with our first child. The country was heading into a recession. Layoffs were kind of already starting to happen. And like I said, at the time I was employed and my wife's about to have a baby. And so she's at least not going to be working for a couple months, you know. And for some reason, we thought it was a good idea for me to quit my job and we'll start an agency that we had no experience doing. And we kind of just used, you know, when she was pregnant, we didn't go out at night. We just kind of sat at home and we wrote a business plan together, kind of just for fun, not even really like taking it that seriously that we would do it. And so, yeah, it's one of those things that like hindsight, it's like, what were we thinking? Like, why would we have started a business at that time? It seems like the worst time. But when we started it, it was more of just a branding and kind of design company, like a lot of design agencies. It wasn't civic brand day one. We started the company, we started the agency. What we were really good at is user experience. But when people hear user experience, they're typically talking about like how someone uses an app or a website and
right.
kind of that level of design. And we had, you know, it was just the two of us. For the first several months, it was kind of just me because she was home with a baby. And then, you know, and then she started working and it was just us. And we hired our first employee, hired our second employee. It's kind of growing. We were getting good at user experience and working with businesses. We had some like architect clients that we did their branding, their user experience. And they were like, man, we really like the way you kind of think about things, the way you approach user experience, I think would really benefit these projects we're working on.
And that was kind of like our first segue into like place, because these architect firms, they were doing like downtown master plans, comprehensive plans. And they kind of saw in us like the way we thought about how a user uses a website. We were starting to think about how a user experiences a city, walks through a building, and how we engage those people to understand where are their pain points and how can we make it better. So we kind of slowly like just started helping them with those projects. And so user experience kind of became engagement. You know, I was just talking about public engagement. That's really all user experience is like engaging the user, asking them where their pain points are, what matters to them, what are they trying to do, and then designing a solution. And so we still just do that. We just do it for cities and places. Instead of helping a company sell more on their website, we help places be better. And so kind of through those years, it was a mix where like half the work was that traditional branding stuff, half was kind of place-based. And then, you know, it was kind of an evolution to where we kind of now it's all civic brand, 100%, everything is cities, everything is place.
Was it an extraordinary leap for the two of you to have the courage to start this new thing? You said you weren't taking it seriously, but I wonder if that was a matter of fear about the leap, or it was something else about going into this new path that, as it turns out, you've been very successful with and has grown, and here you are 15 years and counting.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think some of it is like we were just young and naive, you know? And so we were probably like too confident in ourselves. And I think there was a moment where I was like, well, I could always, if it doesn't work, I could always just go get a job somewhere, right? I could always do something else, you know? Even though it was like 2008 and recession and people were getting laid off, I feel like maybe I was like overly confident about that. But I feel like that is a trait or like thing that we look back constantly and we view. I think there's so many moments in people's lives where it's like, not only did they make a singular decision that really changes the trajectory of their life, but they made it in a really specific window of time that like, I don't think we could have done it any earlier. And I think if we had waited any later, I don't think we could have done it. Like we made a decision at a really specific moment. I think some people are paralyzed with the fear of making a decision. So they wait, you know, even like the decision to have a kid, like most people are like, well, I want to have my finances in order. I want to know that I'll be a good parent. And so I think sometimes they wait, you know, and it's like, well, no one knows how to do any of that until you do it, you know? So yeah, we kind of just made the decision to try it. And I think even when we tried it, it was maybe if this doesn't work in a few months, we'll change it. And now here we are like 15 years later and it's still going good. So,
did either of your parents say, what are you doing?
My mom for sure did. My mom is a retired now school teacher, you know, so it was like not in the business world, you know, everything was about, you know, my mom doesn't like change. If I move her couch, she like doesn't like that her couch got moved. You know, she likes things like the same way. And, you know, so yeah, she's like same job, entire career, same district, entire career. Couldn't imagine doing anything different. Whereas I and my wife, like we kind of like change. Like while we've done, you know, we've done what we've done for 15 years, the company's changed. It's evolved over time. We've evolved over time. We've changed a lot. The work I'm doing now, it's the same company, but it is different than when we started. And so I think we kind of like that change and embrace it. And that kind of led to, well, we're not worried about doing something totally different. But her parents, they were entrepreneurs. So I think they kind of saw the value of that her parents also worked together, and that was really rewarding for them. And so I think they like kind of saw the opportunity for us to do a similar thing in our own thing.
In your 20s is a great time to be willing to test that water, right? Because the older we get, I think, the more entrenched we are in the conventions we've established for ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah, it probably gets scarier to say, well, let me take this big leap just of my own volition, right? Like you have to lose a job or have economics or something force you to make a change at that point in your life just out of mere survival.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that we had our first child on the way, like in hindsight, sounds like a scary time to do it. But to that point, it's like it was kind of the best time because, you know, if I had said like, well, let's have the baby, let's like kind of wait like 4 or 5 years. Well, now they're about to go to like school, and where we live, we're going to want to like make sure we're in a neighborhood that has a certain school. And so I might be in a job to where like, well, I can't risk changing this job because then I can't afford to live in this neighborhood. And so you just get locked in. And I think that's where, you know, tying this all back to the place aspect, I think people get locked in to their place and they don't realize how much power they have to change their place or to just change things. Kind of a funny example that my wife and I talk about when our oldest son, Andrew, when he was, you know, when a kid transitions from like a crib to like a big kid bed, you know, that they can just get out of, he didn't realize that he could get out. Like, you know, he was used to being in his crib and then we got him like the big kid bed and he would wake up and just stay in the bed. He didn't realize like, I mean, it took him after a few weeks, he did very quickly. But like at first, the first couple of weeks or nights, he was just like, he would just stay in there and it was like, wait, I can get up. I can go grab that toy that's across the room, you know, and it just didn't click. And I think kind of getting back to that, like people do get paralyzed or they get stuck in their situation. And I think that's how people get stuck in a job they don't like, in a town they don't really care about. And they just stay there forever because they think they can't get out of it. But it's like, no, wait, that's just a fabricated thing.
It's the expectations of everybody around us too, right? And what we think society thinks we're supposed to do. Like we're all kind of keeping ourselves, in a sense, imprisoned in whatever we think that lane, that those conventional grooves are.
Yeah.
It's funny you mentioned the baby toddler kind of shift. With our older boy, who's almost 14, that's when we knew we needed to get him a toddler bed, was one night after putting him to bed in a crib. Yeah. He showed up in the living room, and we both just looked at each other with jaws dropped because we didn't know how could he have done that. Yeah. Until we went and cracked open the door after we put him back in bed and watched, and he'd climb out at the corner over and over and over and over.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny to, I guess, the different ways that we all experience that confidence-building thing of, what am I capable of? What can I do and survive and move forward with?
Yeah.
Another example, I guess, for me, as I'm listening to you and I'm thinking about not only my life, but I suppose especially with my wife and with our family, where are some of those pivotal moments where we've made decisions that would have been scary, that our parents certainly would have coached us against doing? I walked away from a job, the best paying job I'd ever had, when my wife had just given birth to our second son. He's 6 weeks old. She's on maternity leave, earning 60% of her pay. I did not have another job. But it was emotionally enough years of what was going on in that job, I needed to leave.
Yeah.
And for the health of me and the family, needed me to leave. It was such a confidence builder to know that we can do hard things and we can go against the grain.
Yeah.
And not only survive, but thrive even more because of it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you asked about those moments, you know, in those different moments in your life. And my wife and I, we just the other night, we celebrated our 20th anniversary. So we've been married 20 years. And so we were kind of did a little one night getaway and we're driving back kind of reminiscing on life and stuff. And we actually were kind of doing just that. We were going through like, what are those key decisions? And there's literally like six moments that we made a decision. And like I said before, it's not just that we made that decision, it's that we made it in that moment. And I think if we had done it earlier or later, it wouldn't have worked. And I mean, it probably started with like the moment I, you know, asked her out, right? The first time, like if I'd waited, it might've been too long, right? And, you know, and then the moment to start a business together, the moment to, you know, move to Slida, the moment to, you know, all these like different key things that I think if we had tried to do it any other time, things would be really, really different. And I don't know, maybe that's scary. Maybe that's like luck. I don't know. But I think, for me at least, it's like, I think people don't probably realize how much like control or power that they actually have.
I've come to believe those things are possible because we, each time we've done it, it's worked okay. We've landed on our feet and it proves further that we can do these hard things, make these difficult decisions.
Yeah. And I think it's like, I remember a moment, a couple moments in time where it's the same thing, where it's like, I made the decision to do the thing that I wanted to do. And I was like, I was just confident enough that like, well, I'll figure out how to make it work later. I know this is something I want to do in my life. So I'm just going to do it and I'll figure out how to make it work, as opposed to like, let me figure out how to make it work and then I'll do it. You know, I mean, I think it's like building the airplane while you're flying it kind of thing. It's like, it's just like a leap of faith, I guess. You know, you just, you do it and then you figure it out later how to make it work.
For most decisions in life, I don't know if there's any other way to do it. You know, you mentioned parenting and, oh, I don't know if I'll be a good parent. you're not going to know.
Yeah.
And we might not know until the kids are in their 20s and we start hearing, you know, getting our grade reports back from them on things that did not come up in conversation when they were younger.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and there's a lot of ways in which I think, you know, we've naturally been good parents. And I think there's a lot of ways in which we naturally haven't been. And we learn from those and, you know, have to sometimes apologize to the oldest. You know, sorry, we were new when we started with you. Maybe we'll do better with your brother kind of thing. But yeah, you just figure it out. You know, I didn't know how to run a company when I started a company, but you don't know how to do anything until you do it.
I think one of the key things for us as parents, one of the things I'm really leaning on is that we do apologize. We do set our egos aside and listen to them and have conversations in which we give the kids space to share their voice. And you can share that however it comes out. Your anger is allowed. You can even cuss at me if that's going to help.
Yeah.
Because I want them to know that they can trust that I will hear and then apologize as needed, make amends as needed, change behaviors as needed. And I don't recall that being part of my childhood.
Right.
So I sure lean on that, hoping, okay, I'm sure I'm making mistakes all the time, but I do hope that when it comes time that, let's say when they're 25, 30, 35, and they come to me saying, this thing has really stuck in my mind, they can know that I will listen and apologize and make amends as needed.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and that's, I think that's a lesson that my wife and I, we're actively learning that one. We haven't fully learned that, but I feel like just even in the last like year and a half, honestly, like we've apologized to our kids, you know, like, hey, we came on a little hard when you did X and, you know, maybe we shouldn't have reacted that way. Here's why. And we understand how you feel, you know, like, I think that's huge in not just parenting, but just like any relationships, you know, like
sure,
your friends, coworkers, you know, is allowing to, yeah, you can be wrong and apologize.
I think that your grandfather, you've mentioned, was an influence for you in being willing to take leaps and start like your business and things like that. I like the fact that there's that family sort of connection and that inspiration in someone's life. And I don't want to go by this. I'd meant to ask about him a little bit ago. I don't want to go by without kind of giving him that respect of whatever you have to share.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I mentioned my mom before. She was a school teacher. My mom was a single mom. So she kind of, you know, she raised me, but I was like definitely not ever missing out on a dad or a father figure because I had a lot of like really important people in my life. And my grandfather was one of them. I had some uncles that were really, you know, instrumental in that. So I don't ever share that as like a sob story of like, oh, raised by a single mom. You know, it was like, I had a great childhood. It was great. Right. But yeah, my grandfather was awesome. I mean, he was a really amazing person. And he was also awesome because my grandmother was awesome, you know, which is like a thing I think that is a pretty common thread, you know, and a lot of things, you know, it's like, I mean, I'm sitting here talking to you about our company, but it's like our company is what it is because of my wife too, you know, and probably just as much, if not more, but he was like a father figure, looked up to him, super important part of my life. He worked really hard, was really big about like planning for the future, you know, and all that stuff. And when he retired, he got Alzheimer's, passed away really early, like really quick. And that was a big, like, I guess not something I learned directly from him. It was like indirectly, like, I was like, man, he worked his whole career and he was an amazing father, amazing grandfather. But there's a ton of things I think that he wanted to do that they wanted to do in retirement and travel that they just never got to do. It was just like cut short. Right. And so that was like probably not the biggest thing I learned from him, because I learned a ton of things from him. But that was a thing that I learned from him, and that, or just his experience, was like, man, I don't want to put anything off that I want to do because I don't know if I'll ever have a chance to do it. And so I guess back to that, like just making decisions really confidently at certain moments, you know, let's start a business. Let's do this. Let's go here. I don't know how we'll do it, but we'll figure it out because I want to do it. Like that, I think, influenced or gave me the confidence to do it was like, well, because you might not have a chance to do it. So it's like if I said, traveling is important to me, so I'm going to work real hard and travel when I'm retired. Well, what if I die next year? Like, and I don't get to travel. Well, if travel is important to me, can I bake that into my job? Can I make that an important part? So that's the part that I think
is kind of the common thread and goes back to those, like, decide what you want to do and then just figure it out how to make it work. Because if you just put it off, like, who knows? Nobody knows.
It's interesting how much collectively we fear death, yet live as if we're given tomorrow. You know, rather than saying, yeah, this thing, I'm afraid of it because it's going to be the end of everything. Let me live fully. We don't do that. We live with these, I would say, kind of hollow or false notions that life is stable, right? That your job is forever, that your income is forever, that your health is forever. How old was he when he died?
Oh, man. My wife will correct me because she's good at numbers and dates. And
Well, are we just saying yeah. 70s, 60s?
I forget that I'm 44. And so I think of like everybody as like the age they were when I was a kid, you know, so like I'm so bad at age, but my mom had me when she was 19 and her parents weren't.
Okay.
Were pretty young when they had her. So, I mean, he was, you know, he was a young grandfather. He wasn't like, you know.
How old were you when he died?
I was 30 maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you got a good amount of time with him at least.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I was the oldest grandkid. And so like, and my mom had me really young. And so I had a lot of time with him for sure. It's not, you know, like, I mean, there's some other cousins like never really knew him or they only knew him when he had Alzheimer's, you know, that kind of thing. So I really, really did get to know him. I mean, he was young, but our family was young, you know, and like my mom was young. And so, I mean, I remember going to his 50th birthday party, which sounds crazy because I'm going to be 50 in
soon
5
enough.
Years. And like, I don't, you know, that sounds weird to have like grandkids at a 50th birthday party to me, but yeah, I mean, he was young, but I mean, he retired, you know, so he was old enough to retire.
Maybe at a time when retiring was younger than what it feels like it can be now.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of feel like I don't know that we'll ever retire. Like, will we ever be able to retire? Just kind of have to keep doing this. But
I think we feel like we are looking at life and structuring life in a way that if you can pursue things that are of real interest, real passion even, then maybe it's not about wanting to get away from that, right? It's not putting in 40, 45, 50 years of something that I hate,
right.
40, 50, 60 hours a week, so that one day when I'm in my 60s, I can start living life, right? We're like, well, how do we shape life in a way that we want it to be now?
100%.
And so that if I want to still podcast when I'm 90, I get to do it.
Yeah.
I want to do it, I'll do it.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. I mean, I would rather, I mean, and I think that's the thing that I see. I mean, we're so fortunate to live here in Chaffee County and in Salida and that, I mean, I'll see a friend come up and visit me and they go fly fishing. Right. And that's like their one trip of the year.
Right.
And their one day to fish on that trip. And so it's like, man, well, I really hope they catch something, but it's like, for me, it's like, well, yeah, if we didn't, like, I'll just fish tomorrow or next week, or try it again. Or yeah, the river was high. Like, yeah. The more you can intertwine the things that you value and care about, like now, day to day, I think the better. And I remember when we first had kids, like, you know, I think when you first have kids, you kind of get shooken up a little bit because you're like, get a little freaked out. You have all this extra responsibility. I remember for the first few years of that kind of almost being a little paralyzed of like worrying about like, what if I die? Like how, what will they do? You know, to where now I tried to like definitely live to where like, yeah, I don't want to die tomorrow, but if I died tomorrow, we had good times and we did stuff and, you know, I don't know, like, yeah, I definitely agree with what you're saying, though.
You will have spent all of their years to that point having instilled in them and modeling for them the courage to start your own company, to be self-reliant in that sense, to be creative, to be open to experiences and travel and all these sorts of values that, I mean, that's, I think you and I have so much in common, right? We're of comparable age. Our kids are as well. We believe in the values of travel and the education that comes with it. All of these factors that I think we're in tune with.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the only like asterisk I'd put on it or like just point of clarification is I feel super lucky to have like a job that I love and that I get to do, that I get to travel with and that I get to like turn into like a half work, half fishing trip. Like that's pretty awesome. But I also I think that seeing my kids kind of go through school and, you know, people start talking about like career day and college days and things like that at school, I think it's a really good thing that we tell kids, do what you love find a job that you love and you'll never work a day in your life kind of saying. But I also get a little nervous about not wanting to put this pressure that like you have to get your fulfillment out of your job. Because I think that's a whole extra thing that leads to a lot of people being unhappy, is they aren't happy with their job. And I think if you can be happy from your job, that's great. But I don't think you should get your fulfillment in life from your job. You might have a job that it simply affords you to do the things that you want to do, right? Like I definitely don't like the idea of like suffer through a job you hate till you retire and then do the fun things. But if you have a job now, it's not the most glamorous job that you're going to want to come on a podcast and talk about, and it's just a job and it is what it is. I get nervous that I don't want people to feel like, oh, well, that's not a good enough job, or like they need to like quit that job and find some like passion project, a job. I think some jobs can be just a job. And if it takes care of your family and affords you to do the things that you love now, that's the same thing to me. That's, you know, you've nailed it at the same time. So
it's a well-rounded look, and it creates another viable option for our kids to believe in, because they might grow up to think, well, I'm doing it wrong if I'm unhappy with my work. I'm supposed to be happy with my work.
Yeah.
Contrary, I think, to maybe what is a more traditional view too, is you're not supposed to be happy with your work. Suck it up. Don't bother to find something you're happy with, right? Because that's life. Life is difficult for 40 or 50 years until you get to be happy. So I think it's that middle ground where we create that sense of it all works, and you can create how you want this to be, but it's also okay if you just need to do the practical job while pursuing interests outside of it. And over time, by the way, things can evolve and you can shape them.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I like my job, but I also would retire tomorrow if I could, you know, and I would do other things, you know, like it's not, I'm not, my work is fulfilling, but I don't get my fulfillment in life from my job. Like that's the travel and my kids and my wife and, you know, fishing and just doing other things that if I can weave those things into my job, that's better, but that's not coming from my job. But I also recognize like by working hard and, you know, my job affords us to do the things we do. And yeah, I mean, it's cause I think some people also like, you know, social media is like pretty glamorous, right? Like you look at, you know, you mentioned you saw the Alaska pictures, like it is awesome. It is fun. We're super lucky. I also acknowledge I probably post more on social media than the average 44-year-old guy. But I think that's just cause I like feel like I'm surrounded by beautiful things and I want to share them, whether that's fishing or my kids or work, you know, but it's also tough. Like, there's parts of that Alaska trip that are a slog and we're like, you know, 24 hours of daylight up there and we're running meetings and tired and, you know, it's, but the Instagram pictures look pretty fun, right?
Yeah.
So I think there's also that asterisk and balance that like, it's still tough. Like everything's tough. Every job is tough.
That's a good point. And I'm glad that at least over time I've cultivated this willingness to be happy for somebody when I see that they're in a cool place and doing a cool thing. And in part because I know that I have also had those opportunities and I will have more of them. But for some others, as we know, social media can be sort of that trap where everybody else has the good life and I don't. Right. What's going wrong here?
Yeah.
Because it is such an edited version of what we share.
Yeah. I mean, I do worry about that. You know, I mean, everybody has their own relationship with social media and you know, yeah, there's some people that it's not healthy for. And but like I said, I think I've kind of just, in my mind, yeah, I feel like I'm surrounded by beautiful things. I want to take pictures of them. I want to share them. And sometimes it's just for me, you know, to like look back on, get the memory of. And I get that that's, yeah, that doesn't work for some people. I do worry, like, sometimes does it make other people feel like, oh man, they're there. And, you know, I get that. But
we can't manage everybody else's emotions either, though, right? We all need to be able to deal with looking at somebody's something in their life, you know, and not get hung up on the grass is greener.
Yeah.
They've got it luckier bit, you know. We never know what level of work went into creating that opportunity for that career or whatever it is. I want to thank you for being here. And I also want to, I think, give kudos to you and Banner for the work that you do. I think it's really cool and fascinating from a strategic and creative place, and that you get to wrap travel into it and sometimes bring your kids with you on those trips. And yeah, again, Alaska serves as a point in this story of so many things that are of interest to you. And I really appreciate what I get to see there. So thanks for coming on and talking about it.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. And thanks for doing what you do with this podcast. Because I mean, you know, that's how we first connected, right? It was like, the work that we do is about telling the story of places, and that's exactly what you're doing, is like telling the story of places through individual people's stories. And I think, yeah, everybody is part of the story of a place, whether you're born here, you've been here a day, you know, whatever. Like, if you're here, you're part of the story. So I appreciate the work that you guys are doing. So thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening to We Are Chafee's Looking Upstream podcast. I hope that our conversation here today sparked curiosity for you. And if so, you can learn more in this episode's show notes at wearechafeepod.com. If you have comments or know someone in Chafee County, Colorado who I should consider talking with on the podcast, you can email me directly at adam@wearechafeepod.com. I also invite you to rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whatever platform you use that has that functionality. I also welcome your telling others about the Looking Upstream podcast. Help us to keep growing community and connection through conversation. Once again, I'm Adam Williams, host, producer, and photographer. John Prey is engineer and producer. Thank you to KHN 106.9 FM, our community radio partner in Salida, Colorado, and to Andrea Carlstrom, director of Chafee County Public Health and Environment, and to Lisa Martin, community advocacy coordinator for the We Are Chafee Storytelling Initiative. The Looking Upstream podcast is a collaboration with the Chafee County Department of Public Health and the Chafee Housing Authority, and is supported by the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment's Office of Health Equity. You can learn more about the Looking Upstream podcast at wearechafeepod.com and on Instagram at wearechafeepod. You also can learn more about the overall We Are Chafee Storytelling Initiative at wearechafee.org. Till the next episode, as we say at We Are Chafee, share stories, make change.